I feel an immense sense of freedom. And I feel like I'm not in charge. I'm just an observer. And then when the magic comes, you go click.
This photography podcast is brought to you by Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. Here is your today's host, W. Scott Olsen, with another fascinating conversation.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast from Frames Magazine. My name is Scott Olsen, and you know what? I'm really, really excited about today because in the history of this podcast, we have talked to some really cool people. We've talked to people who have designed cameras that are in outer space. We've talked to people who, you know, are working underwater or hanging out of airplanes. We have talked to, you know, a guy who photographed a single atom. Some really, really breathtaking, imaginative, creative people out there. But never, not even once yet in the history of this podcast have we done what we're going to do today. Today, we are going to visit the opera. Today, we are going to move into a kind of expression that stirs your soul, that really does sort of explode your imagination. And not only are we going to be talking to a world-famous, defining opera star, guess what? Joyce is a photographer. Yes, we are talking to Joyce DiDonato. Joyce is, you know, the New Yorker described her voice as nothing less than 24 karat gold. Actually, I got that wrong. It was the Times that said that. The New Yorker said she is perhaps the most potent female singer of her generation. Although it'll be in the past by the time this podcast comes out, her tour for the next couple days, I mean, just a couple days from now, she's going to be in Luxembourg. Before that, she's going to be at the Perelada Festival in Spain. Then she goes off to Napa Valley. Her entire, listen to this for me, she's going to be in Madrid. She's going to be in Berlin. She's going to be in Athens. She's going to be all over the place. And her voice is the kind of voice that if you are into opera, you think, yes, this is the definition. This is the thing that goes in the dictionary. In the column in the dictionary, just to the side, where it explains the term. Joyce's work is beautiful. And her photography, oh my heavens. We know a lot of artists who have one main genre and do something else. And there are parallels, there are cross connections, there are things in there where one form informs the other, involves the other. And I am really looking forward to today's conversation. Joyce, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Well, I have fallen on the floor. That's the best introduction I've ever had in my life. Thank you.
Okay, we're done.
We're done. Thank you very much. Good night.
That's
very kind. I'm flattered. I thought you were going to say in the history of this podcast, this is the only time we've had such an unqualified photographer on the podcast because I know nothing about photography other than I love it. Well, let's start there.
Okay. Well, no. Oh, okay. You have a long career as an opera singer, and you know, even if you look at some of the research, you do some of the background. It was a challenging start. I believe you say on Instagram somewhere that at 26, someone said give it up. You haven't got any talent. At 28, they said sorry, we need someone better. And then of course you explode and you become the definition of the whole thing. Tell me about. Making this an opera podcast, tell me how perseverance played a role in your desire and in your accomplishments in becoming an opera star. Because perseverance, I think, is really braided with something else called curiosity. And I want to get to Emily Dickinson. I want to get to photography. I want to get to a lot of things that are determined by your own interests. So tell me about becoming the star.
Ha ha ha. So, well, I mean, I grew up in a suburb of Kansas City. I mean, mm-hmm. In Prairie Village. And I had a really pretty typical Midwest growing up in that my dad was a church choir director. And my big ambition when I was 10 was one day to sing in the adult choir at church. and I went to a high school where I fell in love with the theater and music theater. And I thought, at 17, 18, I know what I'm going to do with my life with total certainty, and I'm going to be a high school choral teacher.
There you go.
I went to Wichita State University, and I was doing my music ed degree, and I got a bit more scholarship money because I could be in the opera. And that's where things took a turn. I just fell in love with it. I fell totally in love with it. But I was always playing catch up at that point because I hadn't really envisioned myself as a leading singer. I loved music and I loved the theater and I loved expression. But I had to play catch up in terms of just simple technique.
What is it about choral music versus rock and roll or jazz or anything else back then? I mean, did you know you had the deep, rich voice, you know, or was there something about the art form itself that was calling to you?
Well, it was the art form. There was something about joining my voice, my singular voice, which I didn't necessarily have a lot of confidence at the time, to 20 others, and we're able to create something much bigger than any one of us could. And it was about being a part of something, being a part of a team, creating something in four-part harmony that was extraordinary. And it really, that sense of community, that sense of not having to carry the whole load myself, of joining others and building something together. It really, and I loved the music. I loved rock and roll too. But I didn't ever, you know, that was, well, I guess that was my other ambition when I was 17 was to, my goal was to be a backup singer for Billy Joel.
Well, there you go.
I missed that one, at least for the time being, but there's still time.
Oh, we should tell everyone that just before we started recording, we discovered that you grew up where, very close to where my grandfather lived and where I've spent a lot of time. And so now I'm at, did you go to the concerts in Brush Creek? Did you hang out, you know, in the music scene in Kansas City?
Totally. I mean, I was a little bit more on the classic side because my dad, there was a Harem and Jewel artist program, and they would bring all the leading world stars of jazz and classical music and the Vienna Philharmonic. They would bring them to Kansas City. It's a great, it still is a great presenting arts organization. And so it felt like the world came to Kansas City in that regard. And I did attend a Billy Joel concert at Kemper Arena on my 18th birthday.
Oh,
yeah, I did.
Okay, very cool. I saw Stanley Turrentine and Sarah Vaughan and Chick Corea, all sorts of cool people when I was down there.
Amazing.
But so okay, you know, you're good and you're getting a little bit of accolades, but there's a real big difference between being good and being excellent and getting to that next level of, okay, kid, you know, now it's time for the real show.
It took me years and years to do that. When I left my undergrad and had sort of switched my emphasis and my focus to opera singing, classical singing, I went to a conservatory in Philadelphia for 3 years where I was totally relegated to the back corner of the room. I wasn't given any possibility of anything. I was completely overlooked. And so my third year there, I started taking the Peter Pan bus from Philadelphia to New York. It was $25 round trip.
Yeah.
And I would take private lessons there. And I thought, well, if this school doesn't really believe in me, I'm going to find my own way. And that led me to getting into an apprentice program for the Houston Grand Opera in Texas. So I went from Kansas to Philly to Texas. And my audition there, the head guy of the time who ran the opera company just wrote a few words on my audition sheet, which was not much talent. And I was 26 at the time, which was, you know, the time that you should be pulling your stuff together as a singer. Mm-hmm. And I was devastated. And I took a lesson there with the teacher and I started singing for him and he stopped me. And I had thought I'd hit the big time, right? This was a major apprenticeship program. And I thought I'm finally on my way. And the first week, my voice teacher stopped and said, Joyce, I think it's clear that you're musical. I think it's clear that you're smart. But you have no future in singing because you're singing. This is my first week. But he said, you're singing on youth and muscle. And that's only going to last a few more years because the whole apparatus of an opera singer is singing on the breath. And I had somehow missed that real connection. And so we began what ended up being a 3-year project to really rehaul my technique. The first thing we had to do was take away all the muscle memory. I was using all this wrong muscle to create a lot of sound because we're expected, you know, to sing without microphones over huge orchestras, et cetera. And I had to really remove that muscle memory, which was deeply ingrained at that point. And then it took a year to sort of replace that with a really solid technique of breath. And it took me a third year to trust it in performance and in auditions. And so I wasn't really ready to go until I was about 28, 29.
With the change in technique, was there a difference in the tonality, a difference in the quality of your voice? Because I'm already seeing the parallels to photography here. You know, so many of us get bound up in one kind of technique that we can excel at, but we realize perhaps too late is wrong. Was they creating more longevity to your voice or creating a different voice?
Absolutely. It's also, there's a lot of parallels to sports. That, you know, if you're refining a golf swing or a tennis swing, your goal is maximum ease and freedom. Because with the freedom of the proper swing and no tension, or the right kind of tension, actually, that's when you hit the sweet spot and the ball flies. For singing, we're all born singers. The first thing we do when we, you know, if we're lucky, we hit the earth and we start crying and screaming. And we can go for hours and hours. I'm sure out there understand that really well. So our body is actually a natural instrument that is built to do that. But to try and create good sound and to create, especially when you're young and you're trying to make your mark, you work really hard and you use the wrong kind of effort a lot of time to create and manufacture a sound, especially for opera singers. This is also, I know, true for photography as well, any kind of art. It's easy when you haven't yet found your own point of view to imitate and to copy. And so as a singer, you try and copy sound. And if it's not your natural organic sound, it will be fabricated and it will require extra muscle effort. As photographers, once you start to find your point of view, there's an ease to your photos and they feel more organic. They come alive in a different way because it's what you see and what speaks to you aligns and you go,
absolutely.
And you got it.
And, you know, there is that old cliche that your first 10,000 photographs are garbage. That's not exactly true. Your first 10,000 photographs are training. And you learn technique, you learn the gear, you learn, you know, kind of vision. But you finally get to that point of ease. I think that's a brilliant term here. Point of ease where you can develop a voice, where you can develop a style that is yours. In your world, before we get to the photography, but in your world of singing, what is the tension, creative or otherwise, between, say, conductors and artistic directors and you? Because you know, in the photography world, they're called art directors and editors, and you know this kind of stuff. But I'm curious how that creative tension plays out from one form of expression to another.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of parallels here as well. So much of it depends on the alignment of the vision. For example, sometimes people will say, who's your favorite conductor or stage director? And I have a short list. but the thing that I look for from either of those entities is I want somebody to help me find what I can't find on my own in the score or in my performance. I'm pretty capable at this point. I can do, I can give a performance that the majority of the people will be blown away by and go, wow. And then you have a director or a conductor that helps you find that one more percent or one other thing where you go more deeply than you realized, or they illuminate something in the score or in your posture or in your delivery that they challenge you just that much more. And it really hits another gear completely. And that's what I look for. Those people that make me better, those people that point things out or ask questions in particular. I love the people that ask questions and go, why do you think your character wants to kill herself at this moment and not 5 minutes earlier? And you go, oh, and then I run with it and I have a different tool to play with. I have a different color to play with.
Okay. I really do want to get to photography here in a second, but I cannot get over the parallels between the two expressions. And especially in opera, something as simple as blocking, something simple as stage present, it, you know, is very different than, you know, it's cousin musical theater or, you know, it's distant cousins, all the rest of them. Opera is staged very intentionally, visually, as well as in terms of sound. In working through opera staging, does that have an influence in how you compose photographs?
Oh. Yes, it does. But I would actually turn it around. Really, I think photography has actually made me much more conscientious about what is happening visually through my gesture, through my posture, through the angle.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, tell me more.
Well, okay. So here's the thing. First of all, hello to your beautiful audience, because I'm so in admiration of those of you who actually know how to work a camera. Because I'm going to probably downplay myself a little bit. The world of opera, it demands total mastery of many different elements. It is, most people would, if you know a little bit about it, you consider it the height of all art forms, because a set has to be beautifully designed and painted. You have the architecture that makes up the set. You have the extraordinary creation of the costumes and the color compositions and the fabrics and the textures and the cut and the proportion. You have, as a singer, you have to have total mastery over your instrument, your body, what it is doing, and how you land right in the middle of the pitch. You have to have mastery over many different languages. So when you're singing in a foreign language, it sounds native. You have to have mastery over what the difference is between Mozart and Gershwin, and how do you get those styles authentic, but not, you know, completely canned and sanitized. And then you have to have mastery over the human condition, because we are putting off into stage to those lovely audience members who come and share a couple hours of their life with us. We're showing them death and life and jealousy and rage and elation and love and rage. I mean, everything you can imagine to a heightened extent.
Right.
And so I spend a lot of my daytime in my day job working towards perfection, which, of course, we never reach, but that's the goal. And I love it. And it's demanding, and it challenges so many elements of my persona, that when I go to a very admittedly complex world of photography and light effects and, you know, focal length and blah, 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 I don't want to know about perfection. I don't want to know or even tempt myself to think that I have to figure out all the, I like to go wild, shoot raw, and live in the capture of the composition. I think I have a very good eye, and yes, I love playing with that. And I'll look at, you know, I shoot a digital on my, Canon, and then I'll look it back on the viewfinder, and I'm like, oh, why is it blown out? I'm like, I don't know. And then I, you know, and then I kind of figure it out. And then, you know, so I'm the least, this is not a technical talk about photography, but because I allow myself that level of freedom, and it's all, for me, it's all about capturing a detail, an emotion, an unplanned moment, where opera is all planned. You have to work months and months on any piece of music to get it to the point where you can release it and be free. But it takes so much concentration and dedication to the study of it. I love going on a safari and grabbing my camera. I don't use auto, but, you know, I play around with the settings, yeah, et cetera.
Yep.
And I wait for that leopard to come around the front edge of the Jeep. And I just shoot, and I wait, and I look at him, and I'm just, it's so present. It's so alive. And that sense of observation that it allows me through the eyes, because my world is aural, right? It's all sound. Right. And this, my sound is not involved. It is completely a visual world. And what that does is I feel like it has awakened this huge sense of me, so that when I come on stage, I'm not in a sound world. I'm in a three-dimensional world that also involves the visual as well, in a way that it just feels like it became Technicolor for me.
Let's take just a quick break. We hope very much that you are enjoying today's episode. The very fact that you are listening to this podcast suggests that photography means a lot to you. And if that's the case, you might want to have a look at Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. We truly believe that excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit readframes.com to find out more about our publication and use the coupon code podcast to receive a recurring 10% discount on your new Frames magazine subscription. And now, back to today's conversation.
Let me ask about a picture that was sent to me along with some others of yours, but it's not actually one that you took. It's a picture of you leaning out the Jeep window, and there's the leopard or whatever hiding around the back. But I was struck by the caption or the title of the file, whoever titled it. It was titled Happy Place. What about photography makes you happy?
Everything I was just saying. It's that you have to be... No, you don't have to be, but the invitation is there to be completely present and to wait. There's an element of meditation for me about it, because somehow my labeling brain turns off in a way. I'm not thinking about perfection. I'm not thinking something has to be exactly lined up with the beat or follow the conductor, like my day job, which I love. I love being on the opera stage. I feel an immense sense of freedom. And I feel like I'm not in charge. I'm just an observer. And then when the magic comes, you go click, and you're able to take this fingerprint of time. But I find that the happy place arrives when I'm not labeling things, when I'm just observing. It feels like such a place of privilege to be in a place of observation and then dare to just capture it. Because the photos that I keep, I mean, I'm sure everybody listening knows this. You can still smell where you were. You know, you remember the time of day that it was. And what I look for the photos that I keep, I throw a lot, I discard a lot. And the ones that I really keep, they evoke an emotion in me. And I can go back to that. And I immediately go back to that place of timelessness, of being just present. And nothing has to be anything other than what it was at that moment.
Do tell me the origin story here for photography. I doubt it was, Tuesday afternoon. I think I'll go get a camera. How did photography come into your life, and how did it become more important than whatever else?
So it crept in, because I really started finding it before we had a camera in our pocket on our smartphones.
Right.
I had to really actually make an effort to carry my camera with me on the road. And, it's still sort of true, but I was traveling probably 10 and a half, almost 11 months out of the year, mainly between Europe and the States. But to be very honest, the first few years of my career, once I started taking off, I wasn't enjoying it so much. Again, at that time, this was late 90s and right around the turn of the century. You'd sit on a plane and we used to sit down and say hello to your seatmate and then say, oh, hi, where are you going? Business, pleasure. Oh, what do you do? We used to have conversations. I would tell people, yeah, I'm an opera singer. And they would look and they go, oh, you're so lucky. You must be. Wow. And I didn't feel particularly lucky. I actually was living my dream, and in a way, a bigger dream than I ever really allowed myself to think about. But I wasn't particularly enjoying it. And with some work and some investigating about why I felt this way, I was always missing the place where I wasn't. So I was away okay. from home, and I was missing an anniversary or a birthday or a graduation, or I was always thinking about the place where I wasn't. And I started carrying a really nice pocket camera. I don't even remember the brand. That's how inept I am about technology. But it was a nice one. It was a way for me to observe where I was and to appreciate where I was, even if I was missing something at home. And then it became a very free, expressive outlet for me, again, where I didn't have to be perfect. And there were no rules for me. You know, I wasn't publishing there was no art director. I could do what I wanted. And it really helped me connect to the place where I was. And instead of, hiding away in a hotel room in Tokyo because I was with an Italian cast that I didn't speak Italian yet, and they were all together like a clique, and I was all by myself in Tokyo, and I had no idea what I was doing or where I was. I could go out with my camera, and I could find a way to feel at home. So it became my way of being present, but also exploring the world in a free way that made me felt like I belonged somewhere.
Okay, now that leads into a question, and I think you might have just answered it as well. Over in the movie world, there are people like Jeff Bridges, who become famous for taking, photographs of stage sets, of the movies that he's working on, stuff like that. And there are a couple pictures in the batch that I was sent, backstage in opera productions and stuff like that, but not an awful lot of pictures of work. You seem most interested in making the connections outside of work. Is that right?
Yes, because my work is so immersive and mm-hmm. so demanding that it helps me so much to clear my head. Carlos Alcaraz, I love tennis. He was just, everybody's talking about, he went to Ibiza for 3 days. And he's like, I need to forget that I'm a tennis player for a couple days. And he comes back revived, right? So photography for me kind of scrubs my brain in a great way. I do like, especially earlier on, I would do a lot of backstage photos, particularly portraits. And I really enjoyed that. But I feel since, social media and selfies and quick things, I kind of have fallen away a little bit from that with my camera. And I'm very drawn into nature and architecture and capturing things outside of my day job. Yeah.
Okay. There is a wide range of images that I've got here. You have something that is fairly posed, an image called Shanghai. And then you've got a couple pictures of truffle hunters. You've got zebras. You've got a couple really interesting different takes on the same image in Greece. Is it really just serendipity that's driving you? Hey, this looks cool. Let me take a picture. Or do you create more, some more posed stuff still these days?
I'm generally, I like candid photos the best, where people aren't even necessarily aware that they're being shot. My partner is the Shanghai image, and he's a dancer. And so when I see a background, I'm like, you need to go. It's usually the last thing in the world he wants to do, but I'm like, trust me, we need this photo. Like, I want this.
We need a special prayer for the partners of photographers, because I think all of us have said at one time or other, go stand over there.
It's true. But I'm like, no, do that pose, do that one dance, do the arabesque here.
Yeah.
And he, of course, he's always in a public place, and it's of course he doesn't want to draw attention. I understand that. But I've gotten some pretty cool shots of him in pretty fantastic places that way.
Okay, I want to get to some specific pictures in just a minute, but you've got probably an equal split between black and white and color here, just because that's the way it looks better to you, or is there some intentionality here that you think one works better for a certain composition?
That's completely instinct and completely without any regard to standards or whatever. I'm flying so above my pay grade here. It's, you know, for me, the photos are emotion. And sometimes there is the, I see a photo, like I have a picture of my partner and his son in hands and, you know, touching each other. And that is such a timeless gesture. And it's so symbolic, full of so much, so many stories.
But this is not a snapshot. It's well lit. It's well composed. You've got, I mean, it is a technically excellent image as well.
You made my day. Thank you, Scott. That's a total snapshot. That's a total snapshot.
Well, then the gods were shining on you that day.
Well, see, here's the thing. I know when a good photo is ready. Like I can see it, and I don't know how to set it up. You know, like if I had to light that photo myself, I wouldn't know where to go. But I can see when it's ready, and when I can see when the light is right. I just don't want to orchestrate it, or I don't know how to orchestrate it. But this one it was a clear background, and it was a beautiful moment. I was like, oh, you guys, put your hands together. So it's slightly posed, but it comes out of seeing the potential of that in the moment.
Okay, but then tell me about the two different takes on the Greece doorway.
It's two different treatments of two different... This is actually was a house of a friend of mine that's done by a wonderful architect, Axel Verwoerd. He's from Antwerp, a Dutch architect, and very clean lines and all about the light doing the work. And so this was it was in Greece, and it was the perfect daylight moment. Of course, you know, 3 hours later, this would look very different, but it really moved me. And I sat there and I played with it several different times, and just I was fooling around with settings, etc. What I didn't send here too is there were also kids running and with water guns, and so I have a lot of photos as well that they look like they're, you know, kids, like sniper children with plastic water guns, naked except for, you know, underwear, running. But and those are also good photos, and in the same series and in the same shot. But I loved that this almost looks like a Rothko painting.
Yeah.
And but the simplicity of the material of the steps, no handrail. I mean, it's just, I loved the simplicity.
Well, I mean, it's a very formal picture. It's a very elegant picture. And I love, you say you're playing with settings, but of course that belies the fact that it's not just a snapshot. You sat there and you said, this looks good to me. This also looks good to me. Let's try, oh, that looks good to me. Yeah. So the more abstract elements of aesthetics are actually coming in here quite strongly in the way you're using line, the way you're using shapes. I mean, really, really, and I love the fact that I got, you know, a couple of them here. I can see a whole motif on this doorway and the way light plays through it. Mm. Tell me some stories about Peru, because I have a number of pictures from there. Clearly, you were loving being there. So what about the Peru market and the people there appealed to you and the images that you sent along?
Oh, well, I mean, it was... Where do you start about Peru? Where do you start? It's so full of color. Mm-hmm. It's so full of, this was in Cusco, actually, where we were. And this, we went to a very off the beaten track market. So it was not touristy at all. I mean, it was the opposite. And I was so overwhelmed by the purity of people's faces. They were so open. There was no sense of any kind of masking to fit in with society or expectation that, you know, you walk in London and everybody's dressed a certain way. In New York, all the women, we all have our black sunglasses and we're all dressing the part. And there was something so unfiltered and beautifully pure about the people. And so I got a lot of photos of kids. You know, you go to the market and there's a butcher stand and you know, you're clearly in a economically different situation, and it's a very humble market, and you see the mother working with the meat, the father is back behind doing something, and the school age children are playing around in the dirt and the blood of the butcher on the ground. And this is their school, and this is their life, and this is their reality. And their faces are smiling, and they are laughing, and they are playing. And it's a scene that certainly I never experienced in Prairie Village, Kansas. And the purity, the humility, and the beauty that was there. I have this picture of this older lady, and she must be 80 years old. And she came, and she was counting pennies to buy a potato. That was her purchase that day. Mm-hmm. But such a beauty, she doesn't have teeth, but her face is so beautiful, so full of wisdom, so full of tranquility, ease, suffering, but beauty. And then as she was walking away, I captured her as she was leaving as well. And her legs are bowed out, and she's carrying quite a lot on her back. And she's got this walking stick. The colors are so alive. She is almost camouflaged as she's walking through this market. And the way the people helped her along the way, there was so much dignity, so much humanity. And I look at this photo and I feel all of that again.
This is going to seem like an abrupt change of topic here, but it's really not, because I want to talk about Emily Dickinson now. Mm-hmm. Everything you've just, I am, as most people know, actually an English professor. And when I was reading about this, I was thinking, oh my heavens, there are all those themes in her work and in pretty much what you're just describing here about intimacy and about being alive in those places. First of all, describe the Emily Dickinson Project for everybody, and why her?
Oh, so there's a composer, he's won a Pulitzer Prize and a couple Grammys, I think, at least one. His name is Kevin Putz, and he's really extraordinary. And he's a classical composer, but he's really a storyteller. And he wrote an opera that was based on the film The Hours by Virginia Woolf. I played Virginia Woolf in it at the Metropolitan Opera. It was an amazing experience. And he came to me as just after we had opened, and he said, "Joyce, I'd like to write more music for you." And I said, "Please, okay, let's do it." And he said, "Because I like this idea of writing about these very complicated, creative women." He'd also mm-hmm. written a project about Georgia O'Keeffe and then Virginia Woolf. He came across a poem by Emily Dickinson that said, it started, "They shut me up in prose as when a little girl, they put me in a closet because they liked me still." And he said it just nearly assaulted him when he read it, and he heard the music already in his head. And he also at the same time had been writing for a group called Time for Three. That's a group of three guys, two violinists and a double bass, but they also sing, and they sing in kind of a grassroots Americana way, but they're virtuosic string players. And he said, "I just see the four of you together around Emily Dickinson." And what he saw and what he felt, I think, was spot on, because we met up. He started writing music. We started workshopping it. And it's been the most fun I've ever had musically. It's an extraordinary project. And we have finished it, the recording. We're editing it in the beginning of next year. 24 of her poems, not narratively set. It's just a real glimpse into the immense, infinite imagination she had. And it's the coolest thing I've ever been a part of.
That, you know, and knowing Emily Dickinson's work, knowing the poetry is putting a form around an emotion. You know, the form is, you know, whatever form the poem may be. Opera, very much the same thing, putting a very stylized form around deep human concerns. And here I am looking at your pictures from Peru, from Africa, from a beach in Nantucket. And all of them seem to be really expressing that same kind of intimacy and love, the kind of stuff that I think brings all of us finally to photography. And we say, yes, I see something in there which is illuminating. I see something, you know, in the child on the beach or the zebra by the tree that's illuminating something much, much deeper and much more important for all of us. Joyce, it is extraordinary work. I am glad you're an opera singer because I'm a fan. I love listening to your voice. And I'm glad you're a photographer. This is absolutely some fantastic work. Thank you very much. This has been a magnificent conversation.
Scott, I appreciate it a lot. It's fun for me to talk about all that creative parallels in our world.
Okay. Well, I am certainly going to be standing in line to get the Emily Dickinson recording too. So anyway, ma'am, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Take care.
Frames, because excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit us at www.readframes.com.